Music and Booze with Mo is co-produced and distributed by Nitty Grits, the media division of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, changing the world one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there is a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink. Today you get to join us in a very noisy bar in New Orleans. What's it called? I don't remember, but it was quite the fun dive bar. And I had the opportunity to interview a San Francisco legend, Marco Valdo Dionysus. It's quite a mouthful of a name. And he gave it to himself, which we learn all about during the course of this interview. He has been nominated as America's Best Bartender several times, always a bridesmaid, maybe next year. And he, in the city of San Francisco, has worked at such wonderful major bars, actually, as Rye and Absinthe. I met him during his 7-year tenure at Smuggler's Cove. And he also, he will go down in history as the inventor of the chartreuse swizzle, which is one of my favorite cocktails ever. And we'll get to hear the story of how that came about and much, much more. So, you ready? Let's sit down and bring the noise.
Hey, mama, hey, mama, hey.
I know, I feel like I should start by saying.
Boom, shakalaka, boom.
We're in New Orleans. That's all we need to say, right? That's pretty much it. Well, actually, you
I say, do the bam, bam, boogie, sit down, dum, the boogie, do the bam, dum, the boogie, the beat, meow. Like, I don't know what, like, where are we recording right now?
No, well, it's totally recording, right, but I can edit great. That shit right, out if you cool. want to.
Yeah, that's cool.
But I think, let's just leave it, because we're in fucking New Orleans.
Oh!
Is this one of your songs? Oh, shit, you picked Rocky Amadeus?
Yeah, I was in fucking Germany in 1985. The only German I know is right here. Ready?
Is it? Okay.
Es war ein Punkt in die große Stadt, es war in Wien, war Wien. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Shit. But wait, what if this is the English version? Then your whole German Rock is like...
Rock me all the time to the top. Es war ein Punk unterlebte in die große Stadt. Es war in Wien, wo wir jener, wo er alles stand. Hatte Schulden, den trug, doch lieben leider Frauen. Jedes rief, komm und rock mich an
das.
Er war superstar, er war so populär, er war so exaltiert, because er hatte Flair. Er war ein, wo du wusste, war ein Rocky Idol. Alles rief, komm und rock mich an das.
All right, let me just say, part of my family is German. I'm a little turned on right now. Also, this actually isn't my favorite Falco song. My favorite Falco song is Vienna Calling.
Also familiar.
Mm-hmm. I figured you must be if you can do the German version of Rocky Amadeus.
Here it comes. Oh, it's about in 17 Uhr, it's in Wien, was ich money in ihm, wo die Banken gingen, in woher die Schulden kamen, war wohl jeder Mann bekannt. War ein Mann der Frauen, Frauen liebten seinen Punk. War ein Superstar, war so populär, war so exaltiert, because er hatte Flair. War ein Gute, war ein Rocky Doll. Alles kommen, rock me Amadeus.
He's doing it in German.
So I was in Germany in 1985, and this was the number one song, and I learned the lyrics, and I came back, and I was telling my friends.
No, I don't know it.
Only this one. Only this one.
Beautiful.
I'm a dance.
I love this song, though. I do love this song. All right. We're going to use this instrumental interlude for you to tell people who you are. Introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Marco Baldo, for short. Marco Dionysus.
And currently we can find you at ABB in San Francisco.
ABB in San Francisco?
I don't want to interrupt your singing. If it's
no, fun. There's no more of this.
Is there no more
chords? Yeah,
no
everything verse? Else is.
All right.
Amadeus.
Okay, well, so
no, but that's about it.
Talking to you earlier, Amadeus actually means something to you. Because you're someone who was brought up on classical music and shit.
Like, oh, for sure.
Like, big time.
Yeah, like...
You gotta tell me the story again, because you told me a little bit yesterday.
My mother is a musician.
Yeah.
She owns a music school now, and it's about halfway between San Francisco and Yosemite.
Okay.
And it's in this little town called Oakdale. She bought an old church, which has a Sunday school building, and like...
The acoustics must be amazing.
But she got this property, and it was her dream to open this music school, and it's been amazing. But when I was younger, she was doing a lot of accompanying for recitals at the University of the Pacific in Stockton.
Oh, wow.
And so every night when I went to sleep, I went to sleep to, you know, her rehearsals or her practicing. And she had a grand piano that was just downstairs from my room, and it was oboe, it was cello, it was violin, it was voice, it was all these different things.
Did she play all of this, or did she?
No. She was the accompanist.
Oh, I see. Got it. Okay.
She's such an amazing musician. She's a pianist, but
she could play adjacent to all of this.
She was kind of the go-to accompanist for the entire Conservatory of Music at University of the Pacific.
Wow.
So she did all of the... Anytime anyone on the faculty did a recital, she was...
That's incredible.
She was the pianist. Anytime somebody wanted to do their senior recital, they were hoping they could get my mom. Right? She's an amazing musician and like shaped a lot of my musical taste, but also like who I am, everything about it.
This is why you like classical music.
Yes.
So listen to classical music. Because I know when I ran into you the other day, you were saying how you went to Napoleon House to get your Pimm's Cup and your Mufaletta.
A couple years ago, I went in and I was like, I gotta go to the Napoleon House. I've been told I need to go here. And I walk in, and I sit at the end of the bar, and I get my seat against
the
wall where I
like
to be.
You're like right now.
Yeah. Right? And I order a Pimm's Cup, and the music on the stereo, and I wish I could remember exactly what it was, but it was something that has a very emotional attachment to me. Like it was something like it was blasting too. It was like Brahms Piano Concerto Number 1.
Okay.
Which
you'd have to hum a bar for me to know.
So it's I grew up listening to that recording, Rubinstein specifically on the piano. But it was like this dun 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 dun, and I'm like hanging out. I'm like I'm having a Pimm's Cup and a Mufaletta in this 200-year-old restaurant in New Orleans, and all of a sudden I get it. I'm like, yes, I love this city. This is amazing.
That's so beautiful. See, I grew up, my mom was into opera, classical. But my mother was a folkloric dancer. But it was South American folkloric dance. So my version of that is South American classical in a way. So awesome. You don't stumble across that often here. I'm not going to walk into Napoleon House and hear some Hawaiian playing. So you can have that moment. That's amazing, though. So did you play any instruments?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to
like
say.
Like when I turned 9, I think it was.
Did you want to play them, or did your mom just encourage you to explore?
What I was going to say is, like, I sat down, like, when I was 9, my mother sat me down at the dining room table, And she said, have you chosen an instrument? There was never any question as to whether or not I would play.
Really?
It was a matter of like...
what it would be?
What will it be?
Why is that? Did you already show the signs of...
No, my mother was a musician and our life was full of music. And we didn't have a TV for... the first 30 years of my life. So,
really?
Yeah. That's a whole different thing, but...
And
I
so,
was around so much music, and my mother insisted that we be a part of that. And my older sister, who is exactly a year older, she had already started, by the time I was 9, piano lessons and flute lessons. And it kind of, I think, in an attempt to go in a different direction, I chose the violin.
Oh.
And within a week, I think I had a 3/4 size violin and violin lessons once a week with one of the best teachers in Stockton. I'm in Stockton, right? So it's... my mother has connections to all the people who are around the University of the Pacific Conservatory of Music. And so I had the best teachers from when I was 9. So I decided I took the violin.
Wow. Do you still play? Like at home?
I mean...
to your cat, your dog, or whatever?
I have a lot of instruments. There was
so what else did you play then? Violin was your gateway drug, essentially?
Violin was my thing for a long time.
Yeah.
There was a point when I was still in high school that I took a seminar at UOP called Violin to Viola. And it was really aimed at people who were already violinists. And it gave you like a little trick, a mind trick, to read viola music, and as if it were violin music, to read down a couple notes and play it on the viola.
Wow.
Because there was like there weren't that many viola players.
Yeah.
Once I did that, I ended up playing viola for like California Honor Orchestra and like,
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because
wow.
Again, there's not a whole lot of 16-year-olds playing the viola.
Yeah, true.
And I was playing it as if it were a violin, but playing it down a couple notes.
But you were around this your whole life, so it was
of course, this is just. Yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Frankie Relax just came.
This
on.
Is my first concert.
Was Frankie Goes to Hollywood?
June 18th, 1985.
Are you kidding?
Nope.
I didn't even know they toured. Oh, they wait, played, you and I are only a month
they
apart.
Played,
so
right?
I'm like, I should have known that they toured, and my best
now,
friend is gay.
Relax. Don't be when you want, suck it to win.
Well, let me ask you a question. We'll,
when you won.
Let's talk about your classical upbringing.
When you want something to win.
Your classical upbringing and your new wave, your obvious love for new wave. So, because, I mean, we're 80s kids. Did you, when you were making music, when you were a teenager, and then you were listening to this new wave shit, did you feel any crossover in this world?
No.
Not at all.
They were separate.
Was it because it was
separate.
Pop music and stuff like that? Because, I mean, the new wave stuff, some of it was pretty theatrical, which is more opera, I guess. You know what I mean?
I mean, yeah.
You know like, a little bit.
There was, yeah, I mean.
Because sometimes you had some
oh,
of the drama.
Oh, 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 oh.
You have some of the drama that comes
no,
with
no, I did.
New wave
I did
music.
A little theater too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Back in the high
right
school days.
Direction. I'm sorry.
You can sing along.
Go
this is your jukebox selection, and we're sitting here interviewing during your jukebox selection. I don't want you to miss it.
Gotta hit me. Hit me. Hit me. Hit me with the old laser beam.
It's kind of perfect.
Ow, ow, ow.
Because this is the music and booze interview.
Laser beam me.
This will be the most music and boozy interview
I've ever had.
Anyone who's listening on the radio can't see that we're doing new wave hand gestures right now.
Relax.
Wait. Don't do it. Oh, shit. I fucked it up.
No. Ready? Watch.
I'm watching you. I'm watching you.
One, two, three, four. I was 22.
Oh, shit. Yeah. And where were you? Were you still in Stockton at that time?
No, no. I had moved to Eugene and then to Seattle. And then I moved from Seattle to Portland.
Oh, wow.
And so I moved to Seattle on my 21st birthday from Eugene.
Okay.
I was there for 2 years trying to get into U of O. I decided to stay there a year to get residency, which was a terrible idea.
Oh,
of course.
I was in Brooklyn and I went to the David Boies exhibit.
Nice.
I know. Do you want to do your shot?
No,
do you
I'm
want
just
to
sipping.
Sip on your furnace? Okay. Everyone knows that this is a podcast where we drink and we booze and talk about music, so we can have sips during the time. So when you made it to...
When I moved to Seattle on my 21st birthday, that's when I changed my name. That's when I...
Oh, went. The name that you just... gave to us is not the name you were born with.
No.
I love it. It's a very movie star kind of name. It's a spaghetti western movie star kind of name. I like it. I'm into it.
So.
Are you the, is your last name the, like, Bacchanalia god?
Yeah, it's the Dionysus, the Greek god of wine, madness,
sex, I've known you for a few years, and whenever I see your last name, I mispronounce it because I'm like, it can't actually be that. It can actually be Dionysus.
Yeah. Well, in Greek, I think it's Dionysus.
So how do you say it?
Dionysus.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Because that's how they pronounce it on the Frankie Goes to Hollywood Welcome to the Fresno album.
Nice.
Under the charm of the Dionysian, not only is the union between man and man reaffirmed, but nature, which has become alienated, subjugated, hostile, celebrates once more her reconciliation.
Why did we not go to high school together, dude?
Right? The lost son, man.
Seriously.
Freely earth proffers her gifts, and peacefully the beasts of prey of the rocks and desert approach. Transform the chariot of Dionysus into a painting. Let your imagination conceive the multitudes bowing to the dust, awestruck. Then you will approach the Dionysian. So I was like, yeah, so Dionysus would be a cool last
name. Me, you, and my best friend in high school.
I know, right?
We would have just sat in a corner just like chanting this shit to each other. Because that was kind of how it went.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you're in Seattle now. You've gotten you have a new name. You have your bartender name.
I wasn't a bartender yet.
But I changed my name.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow, you were moving.
My first name was Mark.
Okay.
When I was born, Mark. My father and his brothers were Tom, Dick, and Larry. And then they were like, Johnson. Tom, Dick, and Larry Johnson. My father's Larry. And then they were like, we had another boy.
I'm Mo, so I always get the Mo and Curly and et cetera.
Right?
Thing, but,
yeah. So they had another one. They were like, all right, so John Johnson.
Really?
Yeah.
You really did that?
Yeah.
Are you only... your mom is obviously creative. You must be the only other creative person in your family.
I'm not, but...
John Johnson?
Yeah, it was Tom, Dick, and Larry and John. And then they passed this creative streak on. They were like...
I'm sure there's sweet people.
Monica, Mark, and Mindy.
Monica, Mark, and Mindy?
Yeah. So my little sister's name is Mindy. Junior high school was a fucking bitch because Mork and Mindy was the most popular. I still have rainbow suspenders. I actually have them.
Are you kidding? You still have them?
Yes, because I wore them every day.
I'm kind of jealous. I had that shirt that had the rainbow across the whole chest onto the sleeves. You know how girls wore those? I had that for a long time. Anyway.
So.
Wow. Okay.
I always wanted to change my name.
And so when you did.
And I did. Yeah.
So you changed it. So when did you start bartending?
When I moved to Portland.
And how old were you at that point?
28. I moved to Seattle when I was 21. I was almost 22 when I moved to Portland.
Yeah. And so you did that, and you were like, and then what were you doing initially? Just the shots and a beer, all this kind of stuff.
No, I was working at a place called Casa Uvecha. Uh-huh. It was the busiest bar in the city. And they had trained me up with the promise that they would give me a job
if
something opened up. Yeah. And,
and you kind of
It was mostly into it. It was mostly margaritas.
I like margaritas. With that.
Me too.
But you were making
margaritas. No, they were kind of okay. Really, it was learning the speed.
So figuring out how to do high volume.
Yeah, for sure. It was high volume without much behind it.
Yeah.
We had two blenders, one for our fruit margaritas, like our strawberry and whatever the blended strawberry and blended raspberry, whatever the fuck it was. Right.
Make it fancy. Yeah.
And then one day somebody came in and they said, can I get a Singapore Sling? I'm like, this is the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Nobody's fucking drinking Singapore Slings. Nobody's drinking them. Nobody knows what the fuck they are. So
you're working in an and bar, basically, right?
What's that?
You're working in an and bar where it's whiskey and ginger and rum and coke and that kind of thing.
Almost all margaritas.
Okay. You're like, to reiterate, margaritas.
The place is called Casa Uvecha. Like, it is like the mid-90s, like, Southwestern cuisine hit.
Wow.
The guy who designed the menu actually came from Coyote Cafe. Like, it is full-on Tex-Mex in Portland. But somebody asked for a Singapore Sling, and so I asked the people I worked with, what's a Singapore Sling? And one of them told me it's just a bunch of
something.
Juice and rum.
Oh shit.
It's 1990.
Yeah, I know.
Three.
We know this stuff, so yeah.
Right?
But yeah, at that time.
And I was like, that doesn't sound right. And so I went to the other one, and Paige was like, I know it's gin. I don't know the recipe, but I know it's gin.
Yeah.
And it's a bunch of juice, kind of. And at that point, I started spending a lot of time at Powell's. Powell's is
Powell's, an amazing bookstore in Portland.
City block.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to get. And I was looking for the oldest recipe for the Singapore Sling, and so I just kept buying the oldest things I could find. And I scored like so many amazing books because
no one else was looking for them at that time.
Nobody
right?
was buying them.
Yeah. You probably found like an original Trader Vic's book or something like that.
I found a book. An original whatchamacallit is the 1939
This book is in your house.
Yeah. No, I didn't. I couldn't afford it.
Oh, you couldn't afford it?
Yeah, no, it was a Charles Baker, Gentleman's Companion.
Oh, shit.
Signed to Trader Vic.
Oh, my God.
And I couldn't afford it, and so I walked away.
Wow.
But I do have a lot.
At that point, did you understand who Trader Vic was? You just saw this?
A little bit. Like, yes.
I mean, as years went by, you were like, fuck, maybe I should have found a way to whore myself out to get that book. No? Yeah.
It was more than I could manage.
But that's but you saw that it existed, and you found the Singapore Sling.
Yeah, I never found the Singapore Sling because nobody has the original.
Oh, well.
Nobody has the recipe.
Well, this is something, it's a conversation that comes up, is that who has the original, because the original ingredients kind of don't exist anymore.
But also, even the place where the Singapore Sling was invented, they admit they don't have the recipe. Like, we lost it. Here's what we make. And so everyone kind of
goes off of somebody else's recipe. But the fact that there was no definitive recipe kept me buying old cocktail books. And now I have like 400 old cocktail books.
Are you kidding?
No.
That's amazing.
Because I kept buying them, trying to find
the Singapore sling.
Source, right? And really, it goes back to the Singapore sling. At a certain point, it was just more like, oh my God, these are really cool. I should keep doing this.
Yeah.
And the Singapore sling a little bit faded away. But that was the original impetus. That was the
wow.
reason.
Wow, so it was one customer who asked you for one drink,
yes.
and it sent you down the rabbit hole of early craft cocktails, essentially.
For sure.
So when you started investigating all this stuff, well, you also, so we can jump ahead. You were there, and I met you at Smuggler's Cove. And you are, but you, before that, you had done much more. So when you were finding these old cocktail books, you yourself have created some cocktails from scratch that are of note. So how, I mean, was that born of you experimenting with these old cocktails?
Sure. Like there was a book I came across, and it's called Drinks by, just called Drinks. By Jacques Straub.
Just straight up drinks.
It's in so reprint simple. By Cocktail Kingdom.
Okay.
But it's a 1914 cocktail book. The
1914?
Author is, yeah, 1914. Jacques Straub. And I found this copy, not even at Powell's, it was at an antique store in Portland. And I was so excited about getting it. And the place that I worked at was closed, so I went to this place in Portland called Zephyro. My friend Kathy was working. And I sat down and I was like looking through it, and she was like, what you got there?
Yeah, we started let's try talking. This.
Yeah, and it was like, let's try some stuff. And I was like, well, this one looks cool. And it was a drink called the Favorite Cocktail.
Favorite?
The Favorite.
That was it? The Favorite?
It's called the Favorite.
All right.
And it was gin, mint, lemon or lime. And dry ginger ale. It was like a mule.
Yeah.
Right?
That would be a favorite. Like, we know in this bar community today, everybody loves a mule.
And so we started playing with it, and she was like, well, it says imported ginger ale, but all I have is like this kind of weak stuff, but yeah. We have this ginger syrup that we make in-house
and then
for another cocktail. Let's amp it up. And we started playing around with it, and we were like back and forth, like maybe a little more of this, maybe a little... And we came up with this version. And we're like, this is fucking delicious. It's like a I don't think I'd ever had a mojito at that point.
Uh-huh.
It was like a mojito, but with ginger and chili and spice. And somehow the name Ginger Rogers came about. And I played around with it a little bit. I made it for a couple of people, but it never took off.
Yeah.
Sometimes the time for a cocktail,
yeah,
like when it takes off, is not when it's invented. It could be years
it's
later.
Later. Yeah.
So I moved to San Francisco, got a job in North Beach at this place called Enrico's.
At where?
Enrico's.
Okay. What year was that?
1996.
Yeah, I was still living there at that time. I didn't know you, though, if only.
Yeah.
So you're at Enrico's, and you bring this drink.
No, but like I was the day bartender, so all I was doing was like picking mint for their mojitos. I took a job at Cat Club. I went to work in the nightclub business. But one of the managers who saw something in me, I think, we kept in touch. And at one point he called me and he said, are you ready? I said, ready for what? He's like, well, I got a project I think you'd be perfect for. I'm helping to open a restaurant, a bar, and cool, so what's the name? You know, what's the concept? And he's like, well, it's kind of brasserie. We have a couple different ideas about what to call it. But what I think is the front runner is to call it Absinthe. And I went, I had this opportunity to go work at this bar that was called Absinthe. And I was like, I'm going to have an opportunity to use all these old cocktail books from the Absinthe era. Basically, the turn of the century, the fin de siècle, you know, that era before Absinthe was illegal, when cocktails were popular. And They kind of gave me carte blanche. And
what year was it open again? 96 or so? Absinthe open. In San Francisco was a really monumental shift.
January 30th, 1998. And I remember the date, partly because there's a plate over the bar with the date, but also because my grandfather passed away like a week before we opened.
The bar opened?
And his funeral was on the day we opened. And so here's this, like, the first thing, the first chance I've ever had to, like, put something together myself.
That's you. Yeah.
It's my baby. Mm-hmm. And I'm out in Lodi.
Yeah. Of course. This is your fucking grandpa.
And I played the violin at his graveside.
I was going to say, were you performing at that? Mm-hmm. As you should have, you know?
And then I went to... came to San Francisco and the bar was open. But it was kind of amazing. After a couple of weeks, you know, being behind the bar, look up and down the bar and every person who had a cocktail, the cocktail was something on our menu. Like,
and you crafted that menu.
Yes. Nobody is drinking, there are a couple maybe glasses of wine, but nobody is drinking Cosmos and not drinking martinis.
Kind of that. And absinthe, my recollection of that period, because it was a lot of like the restaurants were the foodie places, and then there were like rock and roll bars, right? And absinthe was one of those early, I don't want to say craft cocktail, but it was basically what took, in San Francisco, it is craft cocktail, but San Francisco is what took foodie to drinky, as I like to put it. Because it took that same kind of idea of the food world, of having the elements of the ingredients, and transitioning it to cocktails. And for me, having grown up in California, that was the first time I experienced that. And it was amazing, and I loved that. Because I love food, but I love cocktails more. So I love that you guys were taking flavor profiles and blending and mixing and creating these things. And absinthe was doing that for me first. You're like, yeah, I was.
No, I mean, I'm trying to figure out, like, where to go. But
when you went there, when you started doing this, I mean, you weren't even aware you were doing that, were you? Kind of, sort of.
A little bit. I had an idea of, like, I knew that what I was doing was different.
Yeah.
And I knew I was kind of taking a risk because any place that had a cocktail menu, if they had one,
Because at that point, people didn't really have menus.
Classic cocktails they could make.
Yeah.
And so, like, do you have a cocktail menu? Yeah. Manhattan, martini.
Well, it's the basic stuff. Old-fashioned, Manhattan, martini, maybe a mule, maybe not quite then.
And I was giving them a list.
Yeah. You're awful.
Of a bunch of new, kind of, what, new, old.
You're like, it's a twist on a sidecar. Right? But at the same time...
No, exactly. It was.
You had this opportunity to do... You were doing absinthe. And absinthe had been banned for so long.
It was still that. It was still illegal when we opened.
Yes. So it's all Pernod. So...
Or pastis or... Right? You know.
But the thing is, it's San Francisco, which is a bohemian city.
Right.
So you can kind of play with those flavors.
Right.
So for you to, I mean, that's huge. You went right into that and got to, like, kind of be like Doc Brown in the lab, like, right away. Was that super awesome for you?
No, it was great.
Were you stressed out?
What's that?
Were you stressed out, or was it rad?
Oh, both, for sure. I was so stressed out.
How long were you at absinthe?
I had no idea. What's up?
How long were you at absinthe?
Like 3.5 years.
Wow. And it's a for absinthe was a formative bar.
I was kind of panicked. You know, I had no idea what I was doing. I'd come from a bar.
You picked Men Without Hats to play.
I'd come from Cat Club, where there was like almost zero like bar management.
And then you went and did this, and you had free reign. All right, so you had free reign, but absinthe really established you in the craft cocktail world. So it did. It did. And so for you, was that like when you were like, shit, I know what I'm doing here. I actually have an idea about these profiles and stuff.
Kind of, because, I mean, so Tony Abaganim was working at the Starlight Room. And I've been in to see him a couple times and had such a great time sitting in front of him. And he would come to Absinthe and drink my cocktails. And I was like, this is great.
Having
this,
a great time.
This guy is
a legend.
A legend. Well, even then, he was kind of a legend. He'd already created the cable car.
Yeah.
But then he got coached by Steve Wynn to open the Bellagio. And I was like, wow, that makes sense. I mean, the Starlight Room is a huge, you know, it's a high-profile place.
It is a very high-profile place in San Francisco.
So
lovely spot.
Then Harry Dittin came to me, and he wanted me to open up this new place that he was doing. And I was like, yeah, that's definitely the move for me. I need to, like, go work for Harry Dittin. Give me a casino in a couple years. That'd be great.
You're already entering your Elvis era.
Right? And so I opened up Rouge on Broadway and Polk, and it was a disaster.
Like,
in every way.
So confidence is shot at this point.
What's that?
Confidence gets shot.
No, I mean, I knew to get out.
Okay.
I sat Harry Dittin down, and Harry Dittin, you know, notoriously, like, kind of raspy voice.
Yeah.
And I said, Harry, this is... I know what you're trying to do here, but it's not going to work. What you need to do is run this as a nightclub, get rid of the restaurant, get rid of the cocktails, just do, like... He's like, no, it's going to be great. If anyone can do it, it's you. I'm like, oh, Harry. I'm telling you, I'm out. Like, take a look at it. It's really, seriously.
Oh.
And
it failed.
I'm like, take a deep breath. And so then he was like, fuck. All right, 2 weeks? I'm like, yeah, whatever. Whatever you want. 2 weeks. So I kind of went into limbo and, like, was working, like,
yeah,
all over North Beach. Enrico's, Vesuvio's, which was great.
I had friends at Moose's, Red
Lusty Lady, Bubble Lounge.
So, yeah.
I was all over the place. And then, yeah.
And then when did you get sucked into Where I Met You? Was that during that time?
No, that's like 10 years later.
Oh,
like,
my God.
I'm old. I got, like, all these, like, crazy, like...
No, I don't want to cut your story short.
Yeah, so...
So you're cruising around North Beach. You're, like, hanging out in the boho clubs and the lesbian bars and all this. Not really, just...
I ended up working at a place on top of Knob Hill that didn't work out called Boku. I ended up working at the Starlight Room. And the Starlight Room was great, and then I worked at Tres Agaves.
Tres Agaves is good.
But yeah, and at a certain point, I opened Michael Mina Clock Bar.
That's right, Clock Bar, which I absolutely adored.
Right.
Clock Bar.
And I think that's where the Chartreuse Swizzle kind of took off.
Wait, what? The Chartreuse Swizzle took off at the Clock Bar?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it was already... I created it several years earlier.
We're going to have to, like, addendum here, because you've just sort of interluded with a cocktail that is becoming a classic cocktail at this point, which you sort of came up with, but although, didn't you tell me a story about how someone showed up from Texas one time and said to you, oh yeah, I was doing this in my bar too?
Nope.
No? Does it ring a bell? Okay,
nope.
So the Chartreuse Swizzle, which is a favorite drink of mine, is something that you started doing when?
So it was 2003.
Because I thought it was in Smuggler's Cove.
No, it was earlier.
Okay.
Like 2003, so that would have been like 1999. Like,
uh-huh,
right after Absinthe opened.
Okay.
Whoever was in charge of Chartreuse in Northern California,
yeah,
had these cocktail competitions. And I entered 4 years in a row. 1 year I won. 1 year I took second place.
Obviously, you're a Chartreuse fan.
I love Chartreuse.
So you just kept running with
yeah,
the Chartreuse.
So I took first, second, and third. And 1 year I didn't place. And so it comes to the fifth year.
Okay.
and they contacted me and they're like, we'd love you to be involved.
Something with this.
Yeah. And I say, like, I'm kind of over it. Like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Like, every year, I create at least two different drinks, and I pick the one I think will win.
And they don't even notice.
What's that?
And they wouldn't notice. You didn't.
Wait. So, and then I won first, second, third. Like, I've already created 8 original cocktails with chartreuse in the last 4 years. I'm kind of out of ideas.
Just FYI, I'm going to hit you up later, and you can send me all those recipes, and I'll just make them for myself at home. They won't be as good as if you made them. Continue on. So.
No, so again, so like.
Realize this side. Because I fucking love chartreuse. Anyway.
It's great.
It is great. It's a beautiful liqueur. Wonderful. So you finally hit the point where you're like, fuck it. Why am I doing this?
I'll do it. I'll enter. I'll do something. I'll do something more. Goofy. I'll do something like tropical. And that's when the chartreuse whistle happened. And it was kind of just like a throwaway. It was like, I'm going to use this Falernum stuff that I'm really, really fond of right now. And I ended up doing like a riff on what I found out was a swamp water from the 70s.
Swamp water?
Yes, which is like
a drink called the swamp water?
From the 70s that I'd never heard of.
Was it a frat boy drink?
Or was it chartreuse and lime and pineapple.
So you just added Falernum?
But I'd never heard of it.
No, I've never heard of that either. I've never heard of swamp water. Although, I have to admit, I'm not surprised there's a drink called swamp water. So you came up with that, and it was years before you hit Smuggler's Cove.
Yeah, no, it wasn't until I worked at the Clock Bar that it kind of took off.
Cool.
I put it on a couple of menus, but I was working at the Clock Bar. I decided the back bar was so small, there really wasn't room for all the spirits I wanted to put. And I had been on a trip to Cognac with Grey Goose and was really kind of disappointed the whole trip.
Yeah.
It was kind of unfortunate. And so when I started working on this project and I was trying to figure out what brands to cut, I was like, I'm not going to carry Grey Goose.
Yeah.
I mean, thank you for the trip, because they flew me over there.
True.
But you can't buy me, you know? I don't want you to think, like, I'm going to put it on the menu just because
you, like...
I got the trip. Like, thank you for the trip. I'm not convinced. That's cool. And so I didn't carry Grey Goose. Well, nobody told me that Michael Mina drinks Grey Goose. So, opening day. Michael Mina comes across from his restaurant, which at that point was across the lobby.
Across the street, yeah.
In the Westin.
Yeah.
And he comes over and he stands at the end of the bar and I say, Michael, what's up? He's like, how's everything going? I'm like, everything's great. Everything's fantastic. Things going smoothly. According to plan. I'm like, can I get you a drink? He's like, yeah, of course. Let me get a... I have a Grey Goose on the rocks.
And
like,
you don't have Grey Goose on the rocks?
I have none. I'm like, Michael, I've spent the last 6 months creating this cocktail menu. Can I make you a cocktail? He's just like, have you tried our cocktails? Let me give you a cocktail. And I make him a chartreuse swizzle, and he loves it.
Oh, yay!
And so, he loves it. The wine guy, Raj, like, this
loves
is,
it.
This is really cool. The guy who was their beverage guy,
loves it.
It starts showing up on a couple other Michael Mina property menus around the country.
Shit.
And that's when it takes off.
And you're all, I just kind of
so I'm like,
made
okay.
This
up. Thank you. Thank you, Grey Goose. Thank you, Bacardi.
Yeah, yeah.
For...
Is it true, I heard recently that Beyonce is a fan of the chartreuse swizzle?
Some say.
Whatever, you got the Queen Bay on some your say. Camp. In your camp, some so there's say. That. So
when somebody I worked with is like in Paris and got...
And
Somebody asked for it out there.
Asked to work a party, and it was like mostly wine, but they were going to do a punch. And so he contacted me for the recipe.
Amazing.
And then the next day he's like, oh, by the way,
Beyonce's
a fan. There was a moment when I was looking for a bartending gig, and I was still at Rye.
I'm sorry?
I was still at Rye.
Okay.
And then Martin was looking for somebody.
Yeah.
And I heard he was looking for a bartender.
Yeah.
I knew Martin from the early days of the Bartender Skills.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like, I'm looking for a job. I'm looking for a bartender. So we met, and he was like, I just want you to give me 6 months. I'm like, I'll give you a year.
Yeah, you might have given me, what, 7 years?
Seven. Yeah. It's a little more complicated story than that, but that's the short story.
But you really honed your craft.
Yeah.
I kind of love that, considering you just said that the Singapore Sling is kind of what pulled you into learning more about kind of more complex drinks.
For sure.
Or at least it dragged you into investigating that kind of cocktailing, you know? That's amazing.
For sure.
And now you're ABV in San Francisco, which is one of the best cocktail bars in the world, supposedly. I've been there and I really enjoy it.
It's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. I'm going to ask you a question I ask people on this podcast all the time. We're going to take it back to music. Now, do you still play music? Like for yourself at least?
I do.
What do you play? Are you playing violin?
I play a lot of things.
How many instruments do you play at this point? Okay, is this your song on the jukebox, by the way?
Probably.
Okay, I was going to say, we're still 80s, and FYI, the entire bar is fucking singing Human League right now.
Which is awesome. Yeah.
Good job making the community thing happen. What do you play? What instruments do you play at this time?
I have a keyboard, so I play that.
Ooh.
I mean, I grew up around a piano. I grew up around a piano. I never took a single lesson. And my older sister took piano lessons. My mother taught piano lessons all the time, and I saw a lot of them. So I understand the mechanics of it and everything else.
That's me in Spanish.
And, right?
Yeah. You just absorb shit, you know, even if it wasn't informally given to you, but you're around it enough that you get it.
To me, you can have a house, but you don't have a home until you have a piano. Sorry.
That's amazing.
I'm just saying. Like,
I don't know how to play piano at all, but I love...
I'm just saying.
I love the shape of a piano. I love the sound of a piano.
Right.
If I were to meet someone who played piano...
I'd be charmed. There was a time about 5 years ago or so, maybe more, where I thought there's not enough music in my life. There's not enough. I felt like there was an emptiness. There was like a. I didn't have.
But you were brought up with always having music around you.
And it wasn't there. And I kind of like looked around for things to blame and like, why am I not surrounded by music, and decided to take things in my own hands. And so I started, like, I go to as many shows as I can. I go to the symphony when I can. I became a member of the SF Jazz.
Wow.
I go to as many shows as I can. Like, the day I get back from Tales of the Cocktail,
do you you have a performance?
Psychedelic Furs.
Oh, yay!
Fuck yes! I saw them at the Fillmore a year ago, and I'm going to see them at the Masonic. And also, I started collecting instruments. I was like, I want as many instruments as
you know
as I can.
Instruments are beautiful things, too.
They're
really
gorgeous.
Beautiful. I think. I can hang them on the wall and look at them, and I'm okay.
I kind of had to because I ran out of space. But, and for me, it's just fascinating. I'm not very good at many of them. There's a couple that I'm okay at, but for me, it's learning how to play them. Like,
so
the relationships, how many instruments?
Yeah, how many can you play? It sounds like you've got a musical family, so you must be more of a savant than anyone in my family would qualify.
Well, I have about 45 instruments.
Oh my god! Can you pick a favorite? Not really?
I mean, the violin is awesome, but like, there's this, I have this instrument called a strobial, and it's like a violin, but it doesn't have a body. It has horns for amplification.
I've never heard of this before.
Oh, it's so cool.
That sounds amazing.
So you play it like a violin, so I can play it as well as I can play anything. And then these horns amplify it and give it like a real brassy tone.
Oh, that's
rad. Super cool. And there's two horns. One goes out, and then one kind of like a smaller horn goes
like tucks toward back your towards
ear,
you.
Almost like a monitor. Like.
Wow. So,
but there's
that's
no
so cool.
the body of the instrument is gone. There's no violin.
Yeah. Oh my god, that's amazing.
So that's cool.
So you don't have that kind of the echoey hollow body kind of thing.
So that's pretty cool. My
that's
mom
way cool.
Gave me a double bass. Yeah. About 3 weeks ago.
3 weeks ago? She gave me a double bass?
Yeah, she's been talking about it. She has a music school, but she also does an instrument rental. And apparently there are not a lot of kids who want to lug around a bass. And they're
so
kind
you
of
go home.
In the way. So she gave me one. So I have an upright bass. I put it behind my bar in my apartment. I put a hat on it. So like, it's just a really like kind of chubby bartender.
Well, a question I ask people a lot of times is, if you were to pair like a music and a song. Well, I don't know if you make drinks for yourself when you're at home. You probably don't have
to. Really? No.
Yeah.
If I do anything, it's like a beer.
Yeah, like, right. So we'll take it to the bar. Like if you, because it sounds like you could perform at a bar. Because you sound like you've learned enough and you're talented enough that you could do that. So let's put you in a scenario where you're performing in a bar somewhere. What do you want to be drinking? What do you want to be drinking with one of these? Wow, people are super happy here today. So let's pair something up. Give me a song and a drink combo that you would love to do. You know, like this kind of drink with this song. You've got to have some ideas because you're a very musical person. And you've got the flavor thing down.
The performance thing is not something that...
Well, let's not just performance. Let's put it just into whatever you're playing in the bar. Like a song that you love. Because like when you and I were talking about being at Napoleon House and listening to the classical music and having your Pimm's Cup and how perfect that was. That can't be the only instance of that you have.
No, and there's so many classical pieces that I would love to.
Do the classical
I would
pieces make
love,
you the most emotional?
What's that?
Do classical pieces make you the most emotional?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Can I tell a story real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so my mom came over to San Francisco when there was still a Virgin, like, superstore. Like,
yeah.
It was like a CD store. And I was like, we gotta go.
And you said this to your mom?
Yes, and I took her to the classical section, and I said, look, I grew up with so much music, and some of it I know what it's called. There's so many things, I just didn't take notes.
Because you just were hearing it all the time.
I'm just hearing it.
Yeah.
And so my mom and I were like walking
You're
through.
Like, come me a bar.
And she was just like pulling out CDs, and
seriously, it's one of my favorite memories ever of my mother because we're.
Is your mom still with us?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's like one of my favorite memories. Like we're walking through and she would pull out a CD and she'd be like, "Oh, I love this one," and she's singing in the middle of like. And I'm like, oh my god.
Yes, that one. Yes.
And I'm like, and I'm putting it in my basket. We spent like, each of us like $300. Like, each, we had baskets of CDs. And we were just one after another after another. But there's one particular song. And that's one that I heard somewhere. And I didn't know what it was. And I managed to track it down. Like, somebody was playing it in a bar. Not in a bar. Couldn't have been in a bar.
Whatever
it
was.
And I tracked it down. And I bought it. And I listened to it on repeat. And I finally talked to my mother and I said, there's this music that is driving me crazy. And I can't figure out why I put it on repeat. It ends and I put it on repeat again. I just can't get enough of it. And she's like, "Oh, what is it?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's this big Chopin Ballade #1. And she goes, "Oh, well, that makes sense." I'm like, wait, what?
Why? Yeah.
She said, "Well, when you were born, I decided I was going to go back to school for music. And so I started working on an audition piece. And the audition piece I chose was Chopin Ballade #1.
Wow. So you were, these are memories that you can't remember because you were an infant.
Exactly. And then, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Pianist. I almost walked out of that movie because it was so difficult to watch. And halfway through, you get to that point where the German soldier finds the pianist
and lets him live.
Play. That's the PC place.
Oh, shit? Really?
Yeah.
So
I'm sitting here watching this movie thinking, like, I can't watch any more of this movie. This is going to destroy me.
And then
the only thing keeping me in the theater is that if I have to see how it ends, which means watching the first half of the movie again. And then he sits down and starts playing. Da, 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 da. And I'm like, oh my god, fuck it, I just lost it.
Which is a song which at this point is basically just in your DNA.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Like...
Wow.
Chopin Ballade #1, like, period, will reduce me to tears.
To tears.
Anywhere, anytime. And it was
I love that. Because music, and it's part of the reason I started doing this podcast, it's like music, creativity, the food, flavor profiles, blah, blah, blah. They're sort of these primal things that you smell it, you hear it, you taste it, and it takes you to a place that you didn't realize... Yeah. Existed. Yeah. Like a memory you didn't remember until that sound, that flavor, whatever took you there. So amazing.
That's.
I feel like we need to end on that.
What's that?
I feel like we need to end on that. Because.
Yeah. There's so many more. There's so many more moments,
sure,
and there's so many
I'm sure there's.
I knew it was Saturday when I would wake up and the Bach Brandenburg concertos were like blasting. Like
my mother would be like,
"Ah!" It was cleaning day. It was like the day that we like clean the house and like do laundry and everything else. And my mother would like, "Nobody is fucking sleeping," and she would turn on, and it was the Bach Brandenburg concertos, and it was just like in order. You know, and I was always up and going by like concerto #3.
A.m. on a Saturday morning to clean. All right.
I'm up. I get it.
Does that drive you still? Like, I mean, granted, you're working in bars now. The music is totally different. But when you're home, do you drive yourself with that kind of stuff too?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, not quite in the same way, but it's definitely like there's all these little triggers out in the world. There's all these little things where like,
no, there are.
And that's where having that one moment where I was at
Napoleon House, and all of a sudden this music came on.
Yeah.
Now, again, I don't remember what it was. It's probably the Brahms Piano Concerto number one by Rubinstein, which was like, was in heavy rotation in our house. And like, might have been that. Could have been like Rachmaninoff. Like, there's like, there's certain like things that I'm like, that are triggers. And it's great because I go to my happy place like that. And it's great.
That's wonderful.
It's
all right.
Great.
I'm going to end on that. We'll end on your happy place. I think that's a good thing. Thank you so much, Marco. I appreciate you doing this. Because we're music nerds at the end of the day. You can drink whatever you want, but booze is fun. Music is life. That's how it's been for me, and I think it should be for you too. Awesome. Thank you so much for sitting with us.
My pleasure. Yeah.
I think we can finish our shots now.
Much thanks to Marco for sitting with me on a night when he could have been out partying. Well, I guess we sort of were out partying, and we just invited you along for this particular one. He also put together a really, really diverse and interesting and lovely Spotify playlist for us. So head on over to the Facebook page for the link to that, and go visit him at ABV up in San Francisco if you're ever there, because he's a very, very talented and very amusing gentleman. Thanks so much, Marco. Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com. And also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Thanks for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guests and our Spotify playlist, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.